Hi, and welcome to the Magazine Rack on Chris. I'm Emily. Today, I'll continue reading from the April 2024 edition of Prevention Magazine. Our first article for today is from the Health section, titled, Meet the Experts, The Brain Puzzle. Here's what an Alzheimer's researcher is working on, and her best advice for you. The expert, Michelle Malicki, PhD. Is chair of the Department of Epidemiology and Prevention and professor of epidemiology and of gerontology and geriatric medicine at Wake Forest University School of Medicine. Brain function, disease, and aging are among the most pressing health issues we cover at Prevention, and we have an expert in all three on our medical review board. Michelle Malicki, PhD, is a researcher making strides towards better understanding of Alzheimer's disease and other dementias. Here, a peek into her world. How do your areas of expertise come together in your work? Epidemiology, gerontology, and brain health might appear divergent, but really, they all converge. My research focuses on understanding risk factors, sex and gender differences, and the use of blood-based biomarkers for Alzheimer's. We're looking at how to prevent Alzheimer's and other dementias, and how to more quickly diagnose them. Individuals' diagnoses are made quite a bit beyond when they have their first symptoms. So what can we do to speed that up? There aren't enough dementia specialists to see all the patients, so the diagnosis needs to be made in primary care. But primary care is extremely overburdened. We are looking at ways of identifying those at greatest risk to be sure they are screened and at developing both brain health navigators and insurance reimbursement models that would allow nurses or social workers to do that cognitive screening. Should everyone get screened? Not necessarily. Previously, nobody thought we would have these biomarkers to help diagnose Alzheimer's. But now our gerontologists say that people come in basically daily wanting to know if they have these biomarkers. A person in their 70s who doesn't have any cognitive issues might screen positive for one of these biomarkers, but that doesn't mean they're necessarily going to develop Alzheimer's dementia. So it's a personal choice, but knowing could cause unnecessary stress. If you do start to develop cognitive changes, though, it is important to talk to your doctor, because there are interventions and treatments that might be right for you. What about the risks for women specifically? We're trying to understand how the factors that go into women's productive health fit in and contribute to brain health. I think there's a lot out there on menopause right now. But I don't think it's right to say that menopause is a risk factor for Alzheimer's disease. All women go through menopause, but not all women develop Alzheimer's disease. Instead of just saying that menopause is a big risk factor, we're asking more specific questions. Are hot flashes a risk factor? Are mood symptoms? Until we have those answers, what can we do? There's not a set prescription for everybody. But I think a lot of people don't realize there are things that can be done for the brain even after a dementia diagnosis. Many studies have shown that better control of blood pressure can improve cognition. Sleep habits, diet, exercise, and social engagement make a difference too. So whatever you like to do to stay active and engaged, that is the best thing to do. Our next article is titled, Time to Eat, Intermittent Fasting. You've never seen it like this before. What we have here is the best way to restrict when you eat without feeling restricted at all. By Brierly Horton, MS, RD, and Carolyn Williams, PhD, RD. It's not often that a wellness trend turns into a healthy program with staying power, but that's the case with intermittent fasting, IF, the idea of eating only during a specific period of the day. Studies are limited, but emerging science indicates that it shows a promise for being beneficial. A recent review showed that periods of fasting can lower inflammation, which is associated with a long list of health conditions, including dementia, diabetes, and heart disease. Intermittent fasting may also help lower the risk of cancer, particularly for those who are overweight or obese. Research has suggested that fasting causes apoptosis, also known as programmed cell death, meaning your body is able to have more consistent cellular turnover, which makes it less likely that cancer cells will develop. What about weight loss? Studies have shown that while IF can help you lose weight, other methods such as calorie cutting are equally effective. However, IF can help someone limit their intake more naturally, skirting the detailed counting of calories. Plus, it may promote satiety by affecting the production of appetite-reducing hormones. It can also help you target weight around your midsection. A 2013 study at the University of Illinois found that after 8 weeks of alternate day fasting, participants lost nearly 3 inches from their waist, regardless of whether they consumed a high-fat diet or a low-fat one on their non-fasting days. Want to try it? This is the way. There's no single standard definition or regimen for intermittent fasting, and many methods can be very restrictive. One calls for eating during just 4 hours of each day, while another restricts calories to 500 total on 2 days of the week. Neither of those makes it easy to stick to the plan or eat a well-rounded diet. A great option, particularly for women, is called crescendo fasting. This method calls for fasting for 12 to 16 hours at a time, 2 to 3 non-consecutive days per week. And yes, a big chunk of that time includes sleeping. Unlike other forms of fasting, crescendo fasting allows for shorter periods of fasting and for not doing so every day. That's a good thing, because some studies have suggested that women may be more susceptible to negative effects of prolonged fasting, such as disruptions to hormonal balance and changes in menstrual cycles, says Amanda Nyberg, RD, an intermittent fasting expert and creator of the Living Energized and Nourished Lean program. Crescendo fasting may be more manageable for some women and less likely to cause these negative effects, says Nyberg. The advantage of this type of fasting is that it restricts your calorie intake to help you lose weight. But because you're fasting for shorter, less frequent periods, your calories aren't restricted enough that your body will be sent into starvation mode. Also, it's a fasting method that is easier than some other to adopt, stick to, and incorporate in your everyday life. Crescendo fasting explained. Fasting for 12 to 6 hours on 2 to 3 non-consecutive days per week is more manageable method to adopt and stick to than fasting daily. Here's what your week could look like on this plan. Day 1. Breakfast, 7 a.m. Snack, 10 a.m. Lunch, 1 p.m. Snack, 4 p.m. Dinner, last food intake at 7:30 p.m. Day 2. Which is a fasting day, no breakfast, lunch, 11:30 a.m. for a 16-hour fast, snack, 2 p.m., snack, 4 p.m., dinner, 7:30 p.m. Day 3, breakfast, 7 a.m., snack, 10 a.m., lunch, 1 p.m., snack, 4 p.m., dinner, last food intake at 7:30 p.m. Day 4 is a fasting day, no breakfast, snack, 9:30 a.m. for a 14-hour fast, lunch, 1 p.m., snack, 4 p.m., dinner, 7:30 p.m. Day 5, breakfast, 7 a.m., snack, 10 a.m., lunch, 12:30 p.m., snack, 5 p.m., dinner, last food intake at 7:30 p.m. Day 6, which is a fasting day, no breakfast, snack, 9:30 a.m. for a 14-hour fast, lunch, 1 p.m., snack, 4 p.m., dinner, 7:30 p.m., and Day 7, breakfast, 7 a.m., snack, 10:30 a.m., lunch, 1 p.m., snack, 4:30 p.m., dinner, last food intake at 8 p.m. And that's a 7-day plan for crescendo fasting. How to make fasting work for you. One of the hardest parts of an intermittent fasting diet is getting used to eating within a particular window of time. There are ways to make this easier, including choosing a start date that works for your schedule. There's nothing magical about starting on a Monday, but be sure to check with your doctor before you get going. IF is not a good choice if you have diabetes, low blood sugar, or other metabolic disorders, for instance, and it's not for kids, teens, or pregnant people. But if you are a candidate for it, Try the expert-backed tips on the following pages. What can I eat while I'm fasting? If you're fasting, then by definition, you're not eating food. So this is really about what you can drink, besides regular water. Try black coffee. Just skip add-ons like creamer, milk, and sugar. Plain, unsweetened tea. Sparkling water. Be sure to check the ingredients list to make sure it has no juice or added sugar. Zero-calorie drinks that are sweetened with stevia, which may be on the label as Reb A. Electrolyte water. Can you eat whatever you want when you're not in a fasting period? Intermittent fasting isn't a free pass to eat absolutely everything, contrary to what you might have heard. You should avoid processed foods and focus on eating whole foods. Your eating plan should be practical, affordable, enjoyable, and tasty so that it can fit into your lifestyle now and in the future, says Deborah Cohen, DCN, RDN, an associate professor in the Department of Clinical and Preventative Nutrition Science at Rutgers University School of Health Professions. Start slowly. Begin with a 12-hour fast and 12-hour eating window. Build up to a 16-8 schedule, fasting for 16 hours with an 8-hour eating window. Find your purpose. It's easier to stick to intermittent fasting if you have a solid reason for doing it. Keep that big why in mind at all times and bring it to the forefront at the most challenging moments to help you refocus and push forward. Eat breakfast as late as you can. Instead of breaking your fast as soon as you wake up, find activities to prioritize so you can push back your first meal of the day. Do a morning meditation, take a shower, pack your lunch. You can also try pushing breakfast back more and more each day. Ease into your first meal. Resist the urge to go big when you're ready to eat. A small snack with good-for-you fats, as in nuts and seeds, can help prevent sudden blood sugar spikes. For example, have a handful of almonds to ease your stomach into eating while you make a bigger meal. Prioritize protein. It's important to get enough of this nutrient to keep your bones and muscles healthy. A 150-pound woman needs 54 grams or more a day, so include foods like eggs, salmon, and almonds into your meals and snacks. Drink up. Your body can confuse being thirsty with feeling hungry, so when you're doing intermittent fasting, it's helpful to stay fully hydrated. Be kind to yourself. Intermittent fasting takes some trial and error. It's inevitable that your IF schedule won't always go according to plan, says Charlotte Martin, MS, RDN, owner of Nutrition Daily. If you're serious about continuing with intermittent fasting, it's important not to feel guilty, ashamed, or mad at yourself when things don't go according to your initial plan. In that case, give yourself some grace and get back to your regularly scheduled program as soon as you can. Get the book. You'll find dozens of recipes, along with more great advice following a crescendo fasting program in part-time intermittent fasting. $27 at prevention.com/fasting. Our next article from the health section of Prevention Magazine is titled, Caution, Anatomy of a Food Allergy. Here's what happens when your immune system decides something you've eaten is a mortal enemy. By Merrill Davis Landau. It had been a stressful holiday season at work, so Grace Guthrie was psyched for the long weekend she and her boyfriend Duncan had planned in Arkansas's Ozark Mountains in January 2020. The area had great museums and mountain views, and her parents had given her a gift certificate for a famous restaurant. The couple was visiting an art museum when they stopped to eat lunch at its cafe. Guthrie, a 29-year-old diabetic intern at the University of Kansas Medical Center, had known that she was highly allergic to peanuts since she had a bad reaction to them as a toddler. But she was not allergic to tree nuts, so after mentioning her peanut allergy to the waiter, she ordered the cashew sweet potato soup and grilled cheese sandwich. This meal was delicious, but 10 minutes after Guthrie had eaten her first spoonful of the soup, her mouth began to tingle and she felt a lump in the back of her throat. Guthrie had about a dozen peanut allergy attacks, and mouth tingling was the first sign. But in the past, when she'd had only a whiff, as she thought might have been the case this time from possible cross-contamination of her soup, the reaction had been mild. "I didn't want to overreact and scare my boyfriend, so I didn't mention anything at that point," she says. As the couple resumed their stroll through the galleries, Guthrie's nose began running and she started to sneeze. Ducking into the ladies' room, she popped a Benadryl, hoping it would end the reaction. Minutes later, Guthrie felt her throat beginning to tighten and dry up. Her breathing became slightly labored. In a hoarse, croaking voice, Guthrie told Duncan he needed to drive her to the ER immediately. By the time they arrived minutes later, her sinus cavities had swelled so much that they pushed her itchy eyes apart like a grasshopper's. Hives had sprung up on her chest, neck, and face. Most troubling, it became harder to breathe. Her heart was racing, no doubt because her body sensed that if she didn't get medical treatment soon, she could die. The minute she told the nurse at the ER that she was having a peanut reaction, they whisked her inside. "At that point, I felt calm. I knew I was about to get the care I needed," she recalls. Triggers, triggers everywhere. In recent years, the number of adults with life-threatening food allergies has increased significantly. Some are developing an allergy for the first time, most commonly to shellfish, says Rushi Gupta, MD, an allergy researcher and a professor of pediatrics and medicine at the Northwestern University Feinberg School of Medicine. Others first became allergic as children. In the past few decades, rates of childhood food allergies have risen dramatically, and some sufferers carry their allergies into their grown-up years. Some allergies are frequently outgrown, but many continue into adulthood, Dr. Gupta says. In 2019, Dr. Gupta and her colleagues surveyed more than 40,000 adults to try to get a sense of the scope of the problem. They were shocked to find that more than 10%, some 26 million adults, had food allergies, with about a third saying a reaction had sent them to the hospital. A whopping 48% had developed their food allergies as adults. "We did not expect such a large number, but when you talk to adult allergists, they confirm that that's what they're seeing," she says. The most common culprits overall are shellfish, milk, peanuts, tree nuts such as almonds and cashews, fish, eggs, wheat, and soy, the study found. The road to anaphylaxis. Food sensitivities, often mistaken for allergies but not as serious, arise from problems digesting certain proteins, which may lead to gas or bloating. For the issue to be a true allergy, the immune system must be triggered. All allergic reactions, whether to food or something like a bee sting, start when the immune system mistakes proteins in a substance for something dangerous. This launches the helper T cells in the blood that are normally called up to fight infections. The activation of the T cells leads to the production of the immunoglobulin E, IgE, antibodies that reside on mast cells around the body. These quickly release histamines and other chemicals to expel the proteins through means like sneezing or other dilation of blood vessels to help purge them through the skin. These histamine reactions are likely there to protect us if we accidentally take in a toxin, says Elise Liu, MD, PhD, an allergist and immunologist at Yale Medicine. "Such a swift, extreme, full-body response would make perfect sense if you'd swallowed a poison instead of a peanut. It's a good reaction that's been co-opted by an inappropriate response to food," Dr. Liu says. The histamine released in Guthrie's upper respiratory tract soon caused sneezes and a runny nose. Histamine makes blood vessels dilate, which was the reason her sinus cavities swelled, and it also affects the skin, hence her hives. Some allergic reactions can also involve the GI tract and the nervous system, with accompanying abdominal pain, nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, mood changes, or confusion. Most dangerously, the swelling triggered by an allergic reaction can narrow airways, affecting breathing. Equally serious is when dilated blood vessels cause blood pressure to plummet, preventing the heart and other crucial organs from getting a sufficient blood supply. These extreme symptoms, known as anaphylaxis, don't occur with every allergic reaction, but when they do, it can be lethal. In fact, food allergies are responsible for about 150 deaths in the U.S. each year. Taming the beast. Anyone who thinks they have a food allergy should be tested by an allergist, who will ask about prior reactions, Dr. Gupta says. So it helps to start a food symptom log before your appointment. You will likely be asked to take one of two tests, a blood test done by a lab, or a skin test, also called a percutaneous test, in which potentially problematic substances are pricked or scratched onto the skin. Doctors should test only foods that you have a history of reacting to, Dr. Gupta says, because of the high rate of false positives. If the test doesn't yield a definitive answer, you might be asked to take an oral food challenge in which you're given a minute amount of food and watched for a reaction, a risky proposition if you are, in fact, allergic to it, which is why you should only do this under medical supervision. Still, many discover that they have an intolerance of a particular food, not an allergy to it, and they may be able to enjoy that food by taking certain precautions, such as putting lactose drops into milk or other dairy products to help break down troublesome sugars. If you are found to be allergic, like Guthrie, strictly avoiding the problem food is a must, and severe allergic reactions require treatment with an epinephrine auto-injector, often followed by emergency room monitoring. Less severe allergic reactions, those in which the reaction is limited to one body part, such as the skin, and does not affect breathing or the heart, may be effectively treated with an antihistamine such as Benadryl. Still, having had a mild reaction in the past doesn't guarantee that future reactions will be similarly mild, as numerous factors, including how much of the food you ate, whether you recently had an illness or exercised, and where you are in your menstrual cycle, can affect your reaction. The menstrual cycle link points to the potential role of hormones, especially since boys are more likely to have food allergies as kids, but by adulthood, more women do. There is a relatively new FDA-approved treatment for peanut allergies, Palforzia, that might have made a difference for Guthrie had it been around when she was a child. This oral immune therapy involves giving minute amounts of peanut protein powder and increasing doses over time to teach the child's immune system to tolerate it. Many doctors use the treatment for adults, but the earlier that it is started, the better the outcome, Dr. Gupta says. Other intriguing methods to prevent severe reactions or possibly reverse allergies are also being researched. The lack of great options is the reason allergy doctors say anyone with a food allergy must always carry an epinephrine auto-injector, such as an EpiPen or AuvuQ, which, when pressed against the outer thigh to inject the substance, can help relieve symptoms. It is safe and works really fast, Dr. Gupta says. Even after giving yourself such an injection, though, you should seek medical care so you can be assessed and monitored. After she ate the soup, Guthrie didn't use her auto-injector as she normally would have in similar situations, because she knew she was close to the hospital and she was dressed in layers of winter wear and couldn't easily access her thigh. At the hospital, she received an IV of epinephrine and a steroid. Her symptoms began resolving immediately, and she was discharged within a few hours. Note that delaying epinephrine like this is not recommended, as symptoms can escalate quickly, Dr. Gupta says. Dealing with her peanut allergy was what prompted Guthrie to return to school part-time to become a dietitian. She also started a blog, foodswithgrace.com, for people with allergies, but she is determined not to let allergies limit her life. Once Guthrie left the hospital and took a nap at her Airbnb, the couple went to the restaurant for which she had the gift certificate. "I'd really been looking forward to it, and I wanted to do something fun after spending hours in the hospital," she says. She enjoyed her dinner, but after all that drama, she decided to skip dessert, knowing that baked goods are common places where peanuts can hide. How to eat with confidence. Strictly avoiding certain foods is not easy, says Elizabeth Picarno, RDN, an allergy-focused nutritionist in Catanoa, New York, and the author of The Allergy-Friendly Cookbook. Here's how you, or your child, can cope better. Read obsessively. Scan ingredient labels at the store, again when you get home, and once more before using the food to be sure you haven't missed something, Picarno advises. This is important even with the brands you buy regularly, because formulations are constantly changing. Also read labels on the non-food items like lotions, soaps, and medicines, as they may contain nuts and other problematic ingredients. Call the manufacturer. May contain allergy info on labels, which generally means food is made in the same facility as products with that ingredient, is not required by law. If you don't see it, call the company and ask what plant the food is processed in and what else is made on that production line. Have a plan. Before eating away from home, know how you're going to avoid your allergens. When traveling, are you going to pack your own food, order groceries, or eat out? Percaro asks her clients. Check restaurant menus online and call to ensure that they can accommodate you. You must still clearly state your allergens to your waiter, or ideally the chef, after you arrive. Be sure friends and family understand how allergens can be hidden. Sauces and dressings often contain egg. For instance, soy is in many prepared foods. Also, always have two sets of epinephrine self-injectors with you and know where your nearest ER is. Don't ignore your emotions. Food allergies can be stressful. Guthrie says she's often on high alert for weeks after a reaction. Percaro recommends joining a social media support group or talking to a food allergy dietitian or a therapist if your anxiety won't quit. Hope on the horizon. Several promising treatments could help people with allergies in the coming years. Immunotherapy. A patch that goes on the skin, sublingual, under the tongue, and oral formulas are being tested, Dr. Gupta says. Microbiome. The critters in our guts are increasingly thought to play a role in food allergies. Altering them with prebiotics, probiotics, or even fecal transplants may make a difference. Biological drugs. Medicines for eczema and asthma include Xolair and Dupixent are being studied for food allergies too. That's it for this installment of the Magazine Rack. I've been reading from the April 2024 edition of Prevention Magazine. I'm Emily. So long until next time.